Our next case is case 13-1982, UW versus the Department of Youth Services. Sitting in for Justice Lanzinger is Judge Mary Eileen Kilbane from the 8th District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge. We will now proceed with Ms. Flagg.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Jill Flagg, and I represent Uranus Watkins in this matter, the plaintiff appellant. Child sex abuse victims have a unique circumstance. Child sex abuse is predicated on secrecy, manipulation, and shame, and often involves deep psychological trauma. It takes many years and even decades for victims to come forward. That's what the General Assembly recognized when they enacted Senate Bill 17, giving these plaintiffs 12 years past their 18th birthday to file civil lawsuits. They gave these rights to all of the victims. All of the victims suffer this kind of trauma, and it was expressly implicit in the language of the statute when they use the word all of civil plaintiffs in all civil cases in the
Council,
statute.
Counsel, if you could focus in on that. I'm over here. Sorry. you said expressly implicit. How can it be both? Do we have express or is it implied?
It's express in the statute, Your Honor, that it applied to all civil cases. It's the only statute of limitations where they use that language, the legislature uses that language, in the entire code section of 2305, it applied to all civil cases. Also, it is a specific exception to any other statute of limitations within that code section.
Don't we also have, though, under Revised Code Chapter 2305, we have a reference to it also says expressly this statute of limitations for the Court of Claims applies to all claims, even when there is another statute of limitations that might apply. So don't we have to also look at that expression by the General Assembly?
Well, this statute was enacted later in time than that statute, and that statute did not contemplate something like childhood sex abuse. The legislature contemplated that in the context of the severe abuse, repressed memories, dissociation that sex abuse victims suffer. It's unique. It's unique, unlike any other claim made. These are not plaintiffs that are just sitting on their rights. They are plaintiffs that have not yet discovered their injuries. If this was an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim alone, it wouldn't accrue until they fully grasps their injuries. And with sex abuse, the literature and the science support that it takes a very long time to fully grasp your injuries and fully realize that you've been abused and sometimes even remember that you were abused until decades later. So it's unique.
I don't think anybody would disagree with the arguments that you've made.
Yes.
I don't think anybody would disagree about the gravity of the situation and how important it would be. On the other hand, we leave policy decisions to be made by the General Assembly. And the provision that I'm looking at specifically is Revised Code, is 2305.111, that does provide the statute of limitations to all claims for sexual abuse unless a different limitation is prescribed by statute.
Well, that would
and
serve
isn't
to
that exactly what we have in 2743.16?
That would serve to nullify the whole statute if you read that literally. Because other statute of limitations could apply for an intentional infliction of emotional distress or negligence claim. But if it's rooted, the point is if it's rooted in childhood sexual abuse, then it's that 12-year statute. If you read that literally, every other statute, every other claim you could bring with the circumstances of sexually abused children could nullify the 12-year statute. Another indication that the legislature intended that this statute apply to the state and state actors is some of the other language that they use in the statute, and they refer to teachers, coaches, they refer to victims in the custody of the law, hospitals, institution, detention workers. Those are all typically state actors. Only 11% of children nationwide are homeschooled, or I'm not, excuse me, only 11% of children nationwide are in private school. The rest of the children are under teachers, coaches, and other supervisory authorities in a public setting. So that's another indication in the statute that they meant it to apply to state actors. And also, the trauma associated with sex abuse is not unique to private actors. It's not unique to private children in private settings. It's the psychological phenomenon of repressed memories, disassociation, the syndromes associated with child abuse occur in public settings. I don't believe the legislature intended for the state actors to be limited by 2 years. The reason they enacted this statute is because it's good public policy. There's also the child abuse accommodation syndrome they considered. The legislature was in the best position to listen to expert testimony on this subject, have hearings on the subject. They learned about the sexual abuse accommodation syndrome, where it's characterized by secrecy, helplessness, entrapment and accommodation, delayed disclosure, retraction. These are all special, unique circumstances associated with child abuse that the legislature considered. They first had a statute of limitations idea of 20 years to encompass all of these plaintiffs. They then talked about 10 years past the 18th birthday and then settled on 12. 2 years was not even a thought. 2 years would be cruel. I think the most important language here is the language that all civil cases come under this statute. It did not accept the state actions. It did not refer to any state code statute of limitations. It did not refer to the 2-year statute of limitation. It used the word all. The legislature used the word all. And I'm going to reserve the rest of my time, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel?
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Today, UW has offered several reasons to think the Court of Claims statute of limitations should not apply here as a matter of policy. And those policy reasons may well make a compelling case for legislative change. But as the statutes are written today, the Court of Claims statute of limitations applies here, and UW's action is time barred.
So when would a victim be entitled to bring a cause of action against the state detention facilities?
Within 2 years of reaching the age of majority.
Okay, so by the time she was 20.
That's correct.
And what would she be entitled to do if she were abused by her pediatrician, for example?
That would be subject to the 12-year statute of limitations in the Court of Common Pleas.
Not if he worked for a state hospital.
That's correct. That would be subject to the Court of Claims statute of limitations, but a private practice physician would be subject to the Court of Claims 12-year.
Okay, so what's the policy reason that you put forth for us to draw that distinction, how we need to interpret this statute to exclude state actors?
2 points, Your Honor. First, we're not asking the court to make any sort of policy determination. Our argument is based in the statutory text. I can get to that in a moment. We do think that there are several policies that warrant treating public tortfeasors different than private tortfeasors in this context. The most compelling one is that the state wants to promptly identify and correct any state wrongdoing that's going on by state actors. And a 2-year statute of limitations creates incentives for plaintiffs to bring suits promptly. So if there is sexual abuse going
on, counsel, that argument fails immediately in a sex abuse case of a juvenile. because you're already granting them. The state is granting them, the statute's granting them until their 18th birthday plus two. So consequently, if a child is abused at their fifth birthday, they already have 15 years to bring the claim, do they not?
It is true that the tolling until the age of majority makes that less precise, that interest. However, it still works in many contexts, and we have other interests. The state has other interests in treating private facilities different than public
ones. But on a due process basis, we really are setting the state up as having privileges that other tortfeasors do not have, are we not?
That's true, Your Honor, but this court, in a couple of cases, have said that that's not an equal protection clause violation. Just to back up one step, I would point out that we don't believe that any constitutional claims have been properly preserved in this case because they were not raised below and not properly raised in the jurisdictional memorandum.
I'd like to hear that argument, why it's not an equal protection argument, that if a child is abused at a hospital, a private hospital, they have better rights than one that is abused in a state hospital. How is that not an equal protection violation?
We'd point the court first to Krauss versus State. That's a decision from this court in 1972, saying that sovereign immunity itself did not violate the Equal Protection Clause. That is to say that denying recovery to victims of public tortfeasors entirely does not violate the Equal Protection Clause.
But if the same limitations for each category of victim is, but we have two different categories of victims established here, and that's the distinction that I find troubling here.
Well, I think the same thing is true even in Krauss, where there was a distinction between victims of public tortfeasors and victims of private tortfeasors. In Krauss, too, those two classes were being treated differently. One could receive full recovery in the Court of Common Pleas, and one would receive no recovery in light of sovereign immunity.
In Krauss, did the Court of Claims exist?
No, that was pre the Court of Claims.
Yeah,
Act.
So you're talking about a period in which anyone harmed by the state had to go to the legislature and get a private bill to take care of that.
That's
problem.
Right, Justice Pfeiffer.
So that case is really stale. I want to come back to your argument that the state needs to know about these troublemakers within 2 years. Clerics are included. Presumably, churches wouldn't be concerned to know promptly about their problems, or schools?
I'm sure they would be concerned to know, absolutely, Your Honor. But when the state is choosing to enact a statute of limitations on itself, it can reasonably think that its interest in correcting state wrongdoing, which it can reasonably think of as worse than private wrongdoing, needs to be identified quickly.
What about schools? Is the two-year statute applied to school teachers then?
Not this particular statute. This only governs state officers. As I understand it, the statute of limitations in Chapter 2744 for political subdivisions, I believe, is structured the same way as the Court of Claims statute of limitations. We don't have any cases that deal with that conflict, but we think that would also be subject to 2 years by a reasonable
so
reading of the statute.
So if it's a school teacher or a coach, age 20, you're done. If you don't bring it.
That's how we read the statute. I don't think any court has considered it, but that seems the most reasonable reading of the statute. And I point out that it is all about
to
how
you,
these.
It seems the most reasonable reading.
Pardon me, I apologize.
To you, it seems the most reasonable reading.
The most reasonable reading of the statute, not the most reasonable policy necessarily, but of course, policy determinations are for the General Assembly. And here, the General Assembly could have hardly been clearer that the Court of Claims statute of limitations applies to all actions against the state, regardless of the nature of the claim.
What statute is later in time?
The childhood sexual abuse statute is later in time.
That expands the ability to 12 years post reaching majority.
That's correct. Okay. We don't believe that alters the analysis here, because this court has said that the later in time canon only applies where statutes are in conflict with one another. That meaning where the legislature has not informed the courts how the legislature would want the tie to be broken. But this goes back to what
so
Justice.
So you think if you went over to the General Assembly with the argument and told them the argument you're making today, they would all agree with you that they intended to cut this off at 2 years for state actors.
Our position is that we don't need to go over today and ask the General Assembly because they've already expressed their intent in
what
statute.
What do you think the answer would be if you asked legislators what did they intend here?
I don't know. It may be a proper topic for consideration before the General Assembly, but as the statutes are written today, it's hard to say that the childhood sexual abuse statute of limitations applies. And that goes back to something that Justice French was asking about. This is the unless clause, saying that the childhood sexual abuse statute of limitations applies, and I'm quoting here, unless a different limitation is prescribed by statute. This court has applied that unless clause in a case we cite called Abraham versus National City Bank to say that the unless clause makes all of the statutes of limitations in Chapter 2305 subject to other statutes of limitations that could apply. That unless clause, we reproduce in Exhibit D of our appendix, and we think it resolves this case here. The further textual evidence of this is where these two statutes are codified. The Court of Claims Statute of Limitations is codified in a chapter entitled Court of Claims. The Childhood Sexual Abuse Statute of Limitations is codified in Title 23, and the name of that title is Courts of Common Pleas. The legislature could have hardly been any clearer about which statute applies in which court.
Well, let's ask ourselves today, though, because you're at the Supreme Court of Ohio. Let's talk about a equal protection challenge that you face today. You will agree that strict scrutiny is the test?
No, we don't agree with that, Your Honor. We believe that rational basis scrutiny is the proper test. The first step in any equal protection challenge is to determine what the classification is. What are we dividing the world into? And here we're dividing the world into victims of private tortfeasors and victims of public tortfeasors. And that does not involve a suspect classification, and it doesn't involve a fundamental right. So here we need to show that there is a rational basis, that we have legitimate reasons, and this statute advances a rational basis.
So you're saying that equal protection is not a fundamental right?
No, equal protection is a fundamental right,
but the
Equal Protection Clause analysis says anything gets rational basis scrutiny if it doesn't involve some other fundamental right, for example, the right to vote, the right to procreate, that sort of thing. We cite Epley, a decision from this court, and at paragraph 16, they said that treating that this sort of classification is not subject to strict scrutiny.
Let's assume for a second that I agree with you. Give me a rational basis for giving the victims of private abuse longer time to report than victims of state abuse. Give me a rational basis for that.
We've identified four in our brief. I've already talked about one briefly today, which is the state's interest in promptly identifying and correcting state abuse, but there are three others. The second one is that it preserves taxpayer funds. In Menifee versus Queen City Metro, this court said that it is a rational basis for a state passing a law. Third, it comports with—
You will agree that's offensive.
Luckily, I have other rational bases as well.
Fortunately.
The third one is that it's a bright line rule that applies in all court of claims cases, and the state has an interest in applying bright line rules because it's good for the courts, it's good for the state, and importantly, it's good for claimants who need to know exactly how much time they have to sue. And enacting a bright line rule that all actions in the court of claims are subject to 2743.16 gives clear notice to everyone how long they have to sue. The fourth point that we cite in our brief is that it matches how the state already budgets, that Article 2, Section 22 of the Ohio Constitution tells the state that it must budget on a biennial cycle. And in order to budget in a responsible way, we need to know what our potential liabilities are. And so the two-year statute of limitations in the Court of Claims helps that. All of those are rational basis.
Counsel, the next case in here, after you leave, involves the Department of Natural Resources, and they've yet to budget for their liabilities.
The key point about these rational bases is people can disagree with them as a matter of policy. They don't need to work perfectly in every case, but rational basis scrutiny allows the legislature to make presumptions that work in most cases, and we believe that these presumptions do work in most cases. Now, I'd like to make a point about the equal protection arguments that I haven't had a chance to address today.
Before you do that, how do you distinguish when you talk about the legislation's intent, when it specifically talks about victims in custody of law, and then it also addresses people in detention.
The key point there is that if someone brought a childhood sexual abuse claim against their abuser in a detention facility, whether it's public or private, that would be manifestly outside the scope of their employment, and they would bring that case in the Court of Common Pleas. So that would be subject to the 12-year statute of limitations, even if it is a public employee, because serious allegations of childhood sexual abuse would not go through the Court of Claims. The state doesn't step into the shoes of their employees and officers when something is manifestly outside the scope of employment or when their officers and employees engage in wanton or reckless behavior.
So you're saying that the justification here is that you still have the wrongdoer liable in a common pleas court.
That's correct, and that would
not
be
the employer that may have in some way aided, abetted by their oversight and their negligence to allow this activity to happen.
That is the reality, that it would be 12 years against the actual employee and 2 years against the state
of
Ohio.
And the argument would be because they're outside of the scope of their employment. But how would that hold if the employer was found to lack supervision that facilitated that activity? Where would we be then? Would the employer be in the Common Pleas Court?
No, the employer there would be the state, and that would be in the Court of Claims.
All right, so you're still in the state Court of Claims, even if there is a finding that it was reported to the state, the supervisors did nothing, they ignored all complaints, and the abuse continued. You're still saying under those circumstances the state would be protected by the 2-year statute of limitations?
Yes, Your Honor. We think that that's how the statutes run because of this unless clause. The third textual point that I wanted to make today, I mentioned the unless clause, I mentioned where these statutes are codified. The third point is 2743.02, which tells us generally what procedures apply in the Court of Claims. And there it says that the same rules apply in the Court of Claims as apply against private parties, subject to the limitations provided in this act. That means if there's something that goes on against private parties, but there's a different indication in the Court of Claims Act, what's going on in the Court of Claims Act applies.
But let me back you up then. Prior to the enactment of this statute, if the tortfeasor, the individual, let's say the guard, in a DYS situation, perpetrated sexual abuse, how long would that child have had to bring a private action against that individual?
Under Ault versus Jasko, that would have been 1 year after the age of majority, or in a repressed memory case, 1 year after the person discovers the abuse. I see that my time grows short. We ask that the court affirm the judgment of the 10th
District. Let me follow up on your repressed memory. Is that also applicable in this instance, in your view?
We don't think so, Your Honor. In Ault, in Pratt, and in Doe versus Archdiocese, this court mentioned that the plaintiffs there had specifically alleged repressed memory. Here, in the Court of Claims, UW did not allege repressed memory in the complaint, and in response to our motion to dismiss, did not raise issues of repressed memory. So we think it was not properly preserved because it was raised for the first time in this court in UW's opening brief.
And in another case, if it were raised and adjudicated, then it would be 2 years from the date of the repressed memory recollection.
We think that that's an open question because no court, neither this court, the 10th District, or the Court of Claims, applied the Ault versus Jasko discovery rule in a Court of Claims case during the heyday of Ault versus Jasko. So we think it would be a decision, a question for a later court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you've reserved more than 7 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The General Assembly intended to protect children from abusers as well as people with supervisory authority over them. Frequently, children are abused in situations where people look the other way. They're not taken seriously. The abuse is enabled. The legislature certainly in Senate Bill 17 intended for children to get civil justice in these circumstances. I also want to go back to the equal protection argument. I assert that the state of Ohio isn't saving money. That's not even a good answer to the rational basis test. I think they'd save some money in the short term, but in the long term, they wouldn't address the main problem here, and that is they aren't taking the precautionary measures to protect our children in facilities. There's no incentive for them to do that.
Council, did you raise the equal protection argument below?
I did in the 10th district. I did at first opportunity in the 10th district.
So you raised it in the 10th district. How about in the appeal to this court in the memorandum in support
of jurisdiction?
I did
in the appeal in this court and the appeal in the 10th district. There was only one proceeding at the trial level, and that was a 12B6 motion where the trial court ruled that my claim was conclusively time barred based on the sovereign immunity statute.
So in your view, the proposition of law that you've presented does include the equal protection claim?
That's correct.
Do you agree with the standard that this is to be applied as a rational basis?
No, I think it should be strict scrutiny.
Why?
Because it implicates a privacy right, and that's the right to process sexual abuse.
Okay.
That's involved with both of these types of plaintiffs, and that's the statute is specifically about sexual abuse and your psychological response to sexual abuse. That was the intent of the statute.
Counsel, what precedent would you rely on to say that this is a fundamental right and that strict scrutiny should apply?
Griswold, all the major cases involving sexual rights and sexual privacy.
Is there a case in particular that you would point to? I'm over here.
Oh, sorry.
Is there a particular case that you would point to, though, where it's a claim, it's about a claim of sexual abuse as opposed to the abuse itself? Is there a case that draws that distinction?
I think this is unique in the sense that it stems from a sexual act that's involuntary, but the actual privacy right is the right to process an act that is very private, like a sexual abuse act. So I think it's a unique challenge to equal protection in that way, that it implicates the right to privacy through the processing and the psychological processing of the abuse, and that you're basically denying them a class of plaintiffs a right to bring a civil action when they don't even realize that they have an action or their action hasn't come to fruition. And allowing another class of plaintiffs in the private sector to fully, 12 years isn't long enough, really, but to get 12 years to process the trauma, to discover the abuse, to remember the abuse.
Your friends from the state might argue that a plaintiff in this situation would still have the ability to bring a claim against the wrongdoer, as opposed to the state agency. How do you respond to that, that there is still that opportunity?
It's not just the wrongdoer that there's an action against.
Would you disagree that you still have that ability to go against the wrongdoer? Do you disagree with that?
You still only have 2 years. You have 12 years. That's correct. Yeah, I do agree with that.
Okay.
They can, the actual private person, you could file a claim against, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Would that not be a little like going against a minister or priest who's almost taken an oath of poverty versus the institution?
Correct. And one of the reasons that sex abuse has been able to permeate is because
there's a worker in a youth facility,
right,
would be one of our lower paid state employees.
That's true. There would never be redress and recourse. And
you could have the satisfaction of a win, but...
Right, which is therapeutic in and of itself, but
yes.
Not...
The financial recovery would be de minimis.
Correct. And no general acknowledgement that other people looked the other way or enabled the sex abuse for the plaintiff. No monetary damages, which is essential for these plaintiffs who suffer, according to the literature, depression, have a hard time finding jobs, have trouble with relationships. They are in need of recourse, and this cuts off recourse when primarily authority figures in the state are state actors. the most vulnerable population among us are these people in DYS custody and other state custodies.
What would you have to show for prevailing against the state if we did allow for the expansion of 12 years here? Because there's no question if the perpetrator is identified and it happened on state property or while he was at work or she, mm-hmm. you'd have to still have more against the state, would you not?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
What would you, not all employers, state employers, and the state would not necessarily be liable if the perpetrator merely worked for the state
right.
when the act was completed, correct?
Correct.
You'd still have the burden of showing the state's involvement, their failure to supervise, their
right.
knowledge but failure to act, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not an automatic in the court of claims. You're still
that's
held
right.
to a burden of proof, are you not?
Exactly. We still have the burden. That's a difficult thing in this case, too, because many of the sex abuse acts take place one-on-one. We'd also have to, in order to sue DYS and the employees of DYS, show that they've been negligent or that they enabled
because
the abuse.
Because the defense here is, even if they were allowed to remain in a case, is that it was outside of the scope of their employment, and that supervisory personnel, the state, et cetera, had no knowledge it was going on and would have stopped it had they known.
Right, and that and the allegation, that's a different, the allegation we're making is they didn't stop it, and that's frequent in lawsuits involving sex abuse in institutionalized settings, that maybe they frequently let kids go off the property with one employee. I mean, there's different policies and procedures that could have been put
in place.
But
that alone is not going to get the state on the hook. That's my point.
Right.
You've got a burden of proof to
pursue.
We have
a burden of proof. That's right. That's right. Not just, right, the Sex Act.
Thank you.
And the sex abuse. Thank you.
We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decisions. Thank you.